I know our we have a recorder on some place.
Yes.
See it here.
It's
all right. We have a recorder. Okay, look at it. Okay, sorry we're late. It's so easy to chat with Andrew when you're sitting here. But I'd like to welcome you to the Active Transportation Committee meeting for Wednesday, August 8th. And it's about 8:54 a.m. So I'd like to welcome everybody. I want to do introductions. Let's start over here.
Katie Droid, Wasatch Press staff.
Christy Overson, Taylorsville.
Helen Peters, Program Manager, Transportation, Salt Lake County.
Peter Tang with UDOT Region 2.
Becca Roll, Salt Lake City Transportation.
Phil Sarnoff, Lake Utah.
Heidi Goodhart, UDOT Planning.
Jory Jotter, Wasatch Front Regional Council, and also just wanted to say that Mayor Ramsey cannot attend today. So.
Jeff Silverstein, Mill Creek.
Joe Shelvin, South Weaver City Mayor.
Barry Burton, Davis County.
Andrew Gruber, WFRC.
Dirk Burton, West Jordan City Council.
Fred Hackett, UDOT Department of Health.
Daryl Valentine, Morgan County.
Let's go on back over here.
Jack Billings, Wasatch Front Regional Council.
John Larson, Salt Lake City.
Jennifer McGrath, Salt Lake City.
Megan Thompson, Wasatch Front Regional Council.
Hugh Van Wagen, an interested citizen.
Over here.
Stephanie Tomlin, Fairview.
Blair Thompson, Avenue Consultants.
I'm Thompson Witcher with Avenue Consultants.
Let's continue with the back on that side over there.
Callie New, Wasatch Front Regional Council.
Will Becker, Green Bike.
Matthew Silski, Wasatch Front Regional Council.
They call for our planning and design.
Danielle Berger, all the planning and design.
Frank Kobe has provision services for people with disabilities.
Matt Seifel, UDOT Planning.
Matt Zamora, UDOT Planning.
Troy Ojoss.
UA, Get Healthy Utah. Sarah Hudson, Get Healthy Utah.
Mark Waterson, Mary Clark Association.
Captain Kelsey, Salt Lake County Health Department.
Roger Boardman, Utahans for Better Transportation.
Tim Hart, with Forex Engineers.
Mark Bradley with Brigham City.
Akroyd, WFRC.
Okay, thank you, everybody. Is anybody that would like to address the committee? Public comment? Okay, seeing none, then we'll move off to the chair report. Who needs minutes? Sorry, if everybody had a chance to take a look at those. Take a motion.
I move that we approve the minutes.
Second. Okay. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Minutes approved. Thank you. Okay. So now we'll go to chair report. So, Jory has a couple things that I can say, I guess, but I'm going to let him do that. But I just want to, I know we're going to be talking about this later in the agenda, but I just want to talk about my experience. I had, was fortunate enough to go up and visit my two daughters who live in Seattle last week, for the whole week, and taking Seafair. But among the other things that we did is we made heavy use of Lime bikes, which is an untethered bicycle option in Seattle. They have both human-powered and an e-bike, electric assist bikes up there, and we were all, my wife's not as active as I am maybe, but we were both able to ride those electronic bikes all over Seattle. I felt kind of a guilty pleasure in the fact that I was riding all over and not getting the kind of workout I expected I was going to get because it was relatively easy, but these bikes had about a 30-mile range on them, and they were basically everywhere. And you know, so I know that there are issues about untethered bikes and them being, clutter and in the way. But the advantage of them were that on more than one occasion, I could walk right out of my daughter's apartment, find a couple of bikes within basically 100 yards, and take off and go. And then when you've done, you just leave them where you stop, and then find another one when you need to do it. It's an app on your phone. It's really easy, and it was relatively affordable. I mean, given the cost of a cab or an Uber or other transportation options, it was affordable. And I know in Seattle, all those bikes had fenders on them. There are probably a lot of days up there where you have to be addressed for that. I'm not really a fair weather rider or a foul weather rider, but we had beautiful weather and it was a great option. It really was a good experience. And you know, that city up there, they learned how to drive more slowly than we do in Utah. And they respect people on the road, both pedestrians and riders. So it'd be nice to build that kind of a culture here too in a much larger city than Salt Lake. But it was an awesome experience, so happy to share that. Jory, you want to finish the chair's report?
A couple other things just so everybody is up to speed. WFRC has had an active transportation planner position open. Seems like forever. We extended it because of the Golden Spoke event. We had a lot of interest. We're still in that process, but the hope is that we have somebody hired here by beginning part of September, mid-September. So they'll be able to attend the October meeting, and we'll get them up and running, whoever we end up choosing. The second item was, it dawned on me last night, was the tour of Utah. So it's made its way up north here. I saw the signs tomorrow, Antelope Island to Layton. Friday is Salt Lake City, Saturday, Canyons to Snowbird, and then Sunday, Park City. So, if you're interested, pretty cool event, I think. Lots of people get out. Some really cool spots to see that. I'm sure Davis County is promoting the tour up there, and same with Salt Lake City and our partners in the Canyons. So, go do that.
The other thing I'll add on that is that I don't want to volunteer them, but I know that they're interested in locating or arranging for other rides to kind of give the benefit to their sponsors of more publicity. So Salt Lake County and Mill Creek sponsored a ride in up Mill Creek Canyon earlier this summer. So they basically came in, had a couple of pro riders, and invited the riding community to join us. It was a what they call a festival ride, so easy ride, mayors could do it. We rode up the canyon up to the gate, and they're doing road work above that, so it was an easy ride. But it gave good exposure to the cycling community and to people maybe that wouldn't be exposed to that. So if you're interested in your municipality or jurisdiction in doing something like that, I know they're looking for opportunities to expand this, and I can give you a contact, Rob Greener, or somebody else that works for Larry Miller on the Tour of Utah project. So. All right. Anything else?
Yes. Just one more comment. Just so you're aware, the Highway 89 project that's commencing next summer by UDOT, we are trying to get funds to replace the bridge over the Weber River. And because UDOT was planning on scabbing the bridge, making it wider, but not replacing it. And they have said that then when they do replace it, they will accommodate a trail underneath. And that's what we're trying to get done. Their structures department at UDOT said that the bridge does, in fact, need to be replaced. But right now, with the scope of the project, they don't have the funding. So I'm presenting next week from Friday at the Utah Transportation Commission to try to get them to move funding for that replacement of that bridge along with this project that's going to happen next summer. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Sure. This is what Mayor Shulman was talking about. This is an example of how important it is to coordinate road work with active transportation work. This connection under the bridge is a really important one for the regional system. It's an opportunity, as UDOT is already doing work on that facility on 89, to be able to add a little more and then make this connection that has been a priority, that is on the priority active transportation list. So I'm just giving some props to Mayor Shulman for pushing this forward as a priority and taking it to the UDOT Commission next week and trying to advance it. So nice job.
South Weber City is basically the missing link between Weber County, Bonneville Shoreline Trail, Davis County Bonneville Shoreline Trail, and also the Weber River Trail.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
So the mayor mentioned e-bikes. Some of you may know we have there's a statewide policy committee. It's called the Joint Policy Advisory Committee. And it's made up of all the transportation agencies, UDOT, UTA, WFRC, MAG, Dixie and Cash, Metropolitan Planning Organizations, and elected officials from all of those. And it meets periodically to talk about funding and finance issues and statewide policy stuff. We had the pleasure just last week of doing our meeting in Park City, and we started the meeting with an e-bike tour. So Park City, as many of you know, is anybody here from Park City?
Nobody's here from Park City, right?
They have just an incredible e-bike system there. Now, they're not pedal assist. Like, they're, I don't even know what you call them, but like, once you get going, it just goes. You don't even have to pedal. So talk about guilty pleasures, right? They toured us all over the city on these e-bikes before we had our JPAC, our policy meeting. And they told us something that I didn't know, at least. They said the most used e-bike system in any municipality in the country, which is pretty amazing, right? It is docked. They're docking stations. But it was just great. So if you haven't been out there to Park City to check that out, you should. And I'm sure our friends that are in Park City and Summit County would be really happy to give information or do another tour at some point. Last thing, so you all know, well, most of you know, that WFRC, we're moving our offices. We've been talking about this for a while. I know at least one person rode their bike here today. Who rode their bike? Raise your hand if you rode your bike here today. One, two, nice job. Of course Heidi did, of course. I was hoping that this would be the last Active Transportation Committee meeting that we have at this office before we move to the north end of the gateway, our new offices. Yeah, I think we're probably going to have one more meeting here. The process is a little slower, but it's moving along. So pretty soon, it's going to be much, much easier to use other modes of transportation to get to WFRC and Active Transportation Committee meetings.
But the good news is you got one more opportunity to ride here.
It's a nice ride, right, Heidi?
Huh? Yes.
There you go.
Airport bike constant.
There you go. Okay.
It'll be cooler.
Gates are kind of annoying, but...
Okay, great chair report, by the way.
Yours too. Yeah. Okay, grant programs, Kip and Megan.
I'll go ahead and start us off. I think this is first. Yeah, so we're going to present all six of our, we're actually going to present these four of the WFRC funding programs for this meeting. So letters of intent for all of these programs are due at the end of October. So we just want to make sure, do a quick overview of all the programs, make sure that everyone's familiar with them, and then provide you with the right people, right contact to go get more information as you start to think through project ideas that you might have for this upcoming funding cycle. So starting off, the Transportation and Land Use Connection Program. Okay. The TLC program is our local technical assistance program for planning, for, you know, connecting land use and transportation planning, thinking through those things together, and working with our program partners. So UDOT, UTA, and Salt Lake County are program partners in this. The mission of TLC is to support local governments to help you accomplish, to help local governments accomplish whatever it is, whatever goals that you have through planning efforts, and then to implement the Wasatch Choice Vision. So this program has $1.3 million annual funding, so it's a drop in the bucket compared to the rest of what we have. But obviously, thinking through these things thoroughly really helps set you up for other projects you might have down the road for different TIP programs. Must be low on battery. Where's Ben when you need him with the batteries? All right, so the goals of the TLC program are to maximize the value of invested in public infrastructure, enhance access to opportunity, increase travel options to optimize mobility, and create communities with opportunities to live, work, and play. So all of these things are really appropriate with this committee being Active Transportation. Increasing travel options to optimize mobility, and thinking through connections to your centers, the way people are moving throughout your city, through all modes. All of those things are things that TLC can help you think through. In the last 5 years TLC has been around, we've funded 65 projects. And 84% of communities within the region have applied. So we'd love to make that 100% this year. If you have ideas, let me know. I can help you think through how they might be eligible through the program. And then, if this works, cool. This is a list of different project types that are able to be funded through TLC, but the project types are limitless. Whatever it is, whatever planning effort it is that you might want to look into, let's talk about it and see if it might be eligible. But active transportation plans are something that TLC has been funding more and more of. We're starting to fill in that map of the communities in our region that have an active transportation plan, which is great. We're kicking off one right now where three communities are working together, thinking through not only active transportation routes through within their city, but how they connect to their neighboring cities. That's Centerville, Bountiful, and North Salt Lake are all thinking through that together. We're kicking off West Valley soon, and we've been able to do several others. We have an interactive map online that looks kind of like this. You can click on all these different projects, see what they did, maybe if they're finished, see the finished product, how much they were worth. So as you're thinking through project ideas you might have, that's a really good resource. Also, this, I have more copies of this. This should be in your packet. This is our report card. This is our third one. So this talks about everything we've done to date. It has all the program information. It also highlights a couple of communities. So Mill Creek City is one of our highlights this year. We've been doing some great work in Mill Creek, a lot of really thorough, good planning, and that's starting to hopefully make an impact in their city.
It's, yeah, so, you know, as a new city, initially with no funding, this was a great help to us. We really needed to do a general plan, and so we got a grant for that to do general plan. And then following on that, based upon some development pressure and other things, we got another grant to kind of like drill down on a town center option to write an ordinance for that. So all those things are going to really help us in terms of planning, and you know, it's comprehensive. When you do that, you're looking at transportation, you're looking at all those things, but really great program and really great help to us when we were just trying to figure out our funding and everything like that. So.
Yeah, we're doing some pretty cool work in Mill Creek. We're excited to kick off the next project, which will be planning a town center, the Wedge area within Mill Creek. All good things. So if you have project ideas, if it's active transportation related, if it's broader than that, most of our projects tend to include some kind of an active transportation element, whether it's how people are getting to the station and back. Let me know, and I'm happy to talk through it with you.
I just want to emphasize something Megan said. The TLC program is administered by WFRC, but it's jointly funded by Salt Lake County, UDOT, and UTA, and WFRC. So it's really collaborative, and I think all the agencies, Salt Lake County puts money in, but it's eligible for our whole WFRC region. And it's a recognition that if we can, by all the transportation agencies, if we can work together, better coordinate land use with transportation early, it'll actually make our transportation systems function better in the long run, and even help set you up for better projects, more better ability to compete for funds for some of the other programs that we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Thanks. Good.
Good morning. Wayne Binion was scheduled to give this presentation, and he's in the Canadian Rockies, and his plane got delayed. So I don't know whether to feel sorry for him or not, but he's not here. Mm-hmm. And so Ben Woodrich, who actually manages these funds, is also on vacation. So I got the call up from the D-League to fill in. And I do work with Ben on portions of the Transportation Improvement Program, which is the program that administers these funds. So, where do I point this? Here we go. Okay, so the first and largest of the three programs is the Surface Transportation Program. And each year we get about $18 million in funds for the Salt Lake West Valley area, $9.7 million for the Ogden-Layton area. Some of the conditions on these funds, though, only facilities on the Federal Aid Urban System are eligible. So in some cases, locally owned and operated roads may not be part of that system. They can be added. There's a process involved in that, but just be aware. These STP funds, we like to call them, can be used for new construction, widening existing facilities, making improvements or reconstructing facilities that have become worn out. New bridges or bridge replacement is eligible. Projects reduce traffic demand, that's another way of saying transit projects, have been funded in many cases with STP funds. Improvements to intersections, widening, expanding, whatever, are eligible for STP. Here's, that's not the picture I was expecting. Here it goes. This looks like one of Ben's slides. Mm-hmm. He likes to do that. So this is the 5600 West project, an STP funded project, including a bike lane. Under congestion mitigation, air quality funds, we get about $5.6 million for the Salt Lake West Valley area, $3 million for the Ogden-Layton area. And there are some special conditions that apply to these funds. The number one requirement being that the project improves air quality. And that's usually done in one of two ways. Either we're reducing the number of trips that are being made, or we're reducing congestion and vehicle delay. So there's different ways of evaluating the benefits of those. All of these are go through a competitive process to select the projects they get funded, whether it's STP or CMAQ. Let's see. Ben's got some more pictures. That's not the one I thought I was going to see. Okay.
Which one?
So, there are...
One of them's got to be right.
This just suggests there's quite a variety of projects that we have funded over the years. Certainly some transit projects, but also we've used CMAQ funds for green bike, park and ride lots, intersection improvements with some conditions, but improvements to intersections can be eligible for CMAQ, and various ped and bike facilities. The scale of a lot of pedestrian bicycle projects are such that competing in this arena can be challenging, but adding those elements into other projects is helpful to get them approved, and we have had a number of ped and bike, strictly ped and bike projects that have been funded with CMAQ. So the last group of funds is the Transportation Alternatives Program. So this is for non-motorized modes of transportation. We have about 900,000 available in Salt Lake West Valley, and 500,000 in the Ogden-Layton area. So this is anything non-motorized, pedestrian bicycle facilities for sure, safe routes to school. There it is on the bottom. Those type of projects can be funded. Here's, that's not the picture I was expecting. I don't know what. That's the one, okay, the DNRG trail. There's an example of a TAP-funded project. So that's the end of my slides. I'm not sure what comes next on here, or if that's all we needed to discuss. Megan, did you have something else?
Okay, I'll take the baton now for a moment, Kip, if I may. So all of these programs that WFRC administers total around $50 million a year. And all of them are eligible to be used to help advance active transportation. A lot of times, the biggest of these programs that we administer, STP, Surface Transportation Program, the majority of the funds go for road projects, but increasingly, we have been expecting communities and scoring communities' applications on the basis of having active transportation incorporated into those road projects. So if you, the eligible applicants for these programs are the local governments. So either if you're a local government or you work in your community or with your local governments, work with them to put applications in for any of these funding programs. Now, remind us, when is the, when do we start up the cycle? Letters of intent?
End of October.
Are due end of October. So this is a preview.
Is it not September? Not end of September?
Start the end of September through end of October.
Okay. That's that opening day.
So in September we will do the official announcement, but this is a like a look ahead for the anticipating these projects are coming up. Oftentimes also these funds get coupled with other funds, city, county, UDOT, UTA funds, you know, pulling various sources together to actually advance projects. So there's a lot of coordination, and this is the, you know, the preview of the funds that are going to be available as we look ahead for the next year.
And the only thing I think I can add to that is that the process, it's, you know, it's an easy process to start. The letter of intent is a pretty simple thing to do. You write a letter about what your idea is. And then Megan and the staff here have been really good about meeting with people and helping with the application. The application is due in January, and then the evaluation process goes on for that. So if you have an idea, you know, get a letter in and then meet with these guys, and you know, they'll even help talk to you about what might help you with your grant. There's elements that might make it more attractive to the evaluation committee. So,
yeah, and MAG has these programs also in Utah County. Okay.
Cool. Thank you, guys. Okay, let's talk about Douglas. So is that are John and Jennifer here?
Yep. All right, awesome. Here to talk about what we're calling Scooterpalooza 2018.
Scooterpalooza. That's exactly what it is.
So it started, you know, a couple years ago. There, we started, you know, hearing about this concept of dockless bikes and the dockless bike share. And it seemed to be taking off. It seemed to be really chaotic. When I took this job with the city last fall, started hearing about it, and I just kept thinking, I'm really glad that that's staying on the coastal cities and not really coming our way. And then I was at a conference in March in Denver, and there was a city council member from Santa Monica who was talking about these scooters, the scooter share. And it was the first time I had heard about it, and it was something that they were really grappling with. And I thought, I better start looking into this thing. And then in May, went on vacation in San Diego, and they had like everything, every option you can imagine. And by then I'd been, you know, hearing some horror stories about how chaotic the dockless companies and products were. I remember thinking, well, there's some things I would want to tweak, but it's not as bad as I'd heard. So I actually, you know, I rode one of the scooters around. I couldn't convince my kids to. I thought they were really cool. My 15-year-old was like, well, that's kind of dorky, but I really enjoyed it. And luckily, it was an organization called NACTO, which National Association of City Transportation Officials, which is just this fantastic organization. And they've been on it, and they have a subcommittee that's been working for a while on trying to give cities some guidance, because we've been scrambling, like, okay, what do we do? And so about the same time that we started realizing that, started hearing some rumblings that this was coming to Salt Lake, we got the draft NACTO guidance. They released a 30-page document that gave some fantastic guidance on dockless mobility, how to manage as a city. And then the weekend before the 4th of July, the birds dropped, and we're like, okay, this is real. So we told them, you can't operate here without a business license, so we'll work with you, but pull back. So they did, and we appreciated that. And so we pulled together teams, and Jim McGrath is here, and we really helped quite a bit, but we pulled together, you know, we had two of our senior lawyers, and we had, you know, people from police and business licensing and real estate, and said, okay, how do we manage this? We think it's a good thing to help people get around without a car, and we want, you know, we don't want to just shoo these companies away, but we want to manage this in a way that makes sense. So we developed a temporary operating agreement, and the plan is that this we have the ability to shut it down anytime things get out of control, but at most the agreements are for 12 months with these companies. In the meantime, we'll be working on developing an actual ordinance with our city council. So we see this as a pilot period and an opportunity to learn, get feedback, see what works, see what doesn't, and kind of move forward from there. And so the mayor's office was fairly hands-off on it. They said, told us, you know, figure this out. And but the one direction that we did get was that we needed to consider equity and bake that into the agreement somehow. So that's why I pulled this up. So the way that we structured this was that you can get up to 500. We're allowing, you know, off the bat, a cap of up to 500 devices per company for now. And we have baked in to this that we'll have a 30-day check-in, which will be in a couple weeks, and then quarterly. But we have reserved the right to do updates more often as necessary to adjust the caps. But for now, just as a starting point, you have up to 500, but it's there's some contingencies on that. So you see the downtown area, zone one, is a maximum of 200, just to avoid oversaturation, because that's where we have, I think, up to six companies now. We only have two in operation. We have two more that are in the process of getting business licenses and one more that has expressed interest. So we said, okay, if there's four companies operating, then 200 would probably, you know, around 800 would be the max in our initial calculations of how many we can handle downtown. And so we came up with, we'll allow 200 per company to start with. And then if you want to add more, your next 100 have to be in zone two. And then and this is how many are deployed at the start of each day. And then once you have at least 100 in zone two, then you, we wanted to, you know, provide an incentive. And so then you could have another 200 anywhere. So you could deploy them all in zone two, or, you know, those additional 200 could be in zone three. And so that's what we've started seeing. So like Bird, within, by the end of their first week of operation, they had hit their 200 in zone one, and then they did 100 down North Temple on the west side, and then they started exploring kind of the Sugar House area. And so it's kind of been fun to watch. We've had to send some emails and follow-ups. We go to page three of the agreement, and so we have, this is that was the attachment A of the agreement that we had with these companies. This is the actual agreement. We're happy to share it. There's nothing sacred or confidential about it.
It's actually
Deseret News. Actually, okay, great. The Deseret News actually on their online, one of their online articles actually attached a draft of this to the actual article. I was like, okay, I guess that's out there now. So these are some of the restrictions that we put in on where they could go, and this was, you know, open to making some adjustments, but we, you know, put a fair amount of thought into this, and it seemed really restrictive. Granted, we have 660 foot long blocks, and so there's plenty of room to work in. But things like, you know, you can't be too close to a green bike station, you can't block ADA ramps, you can't put them in a parking space, you can't block the sidewalk, can't put them in front of a building entrance, you know, things like that. And I think we're making progress towards getting them, the companies and the users, to put them in the right places, but it's not perfect yet.
So you mentioned all of these restrictions apply on the initial drop by the company, right? And you're hoping that riders, if they're taking a scooter around, that they're not gonna, you know, leave it resting against a traffic signal pole.
Yeah.
But it's really the enforcement is against the companies only on the initial drop in the morning, right?
No, they're actually responsible throughout the entire day to enforce it. The initial drop is where, you know, if they're getting that wrong, that's where I take pictures and send them an email saying, we are enforcing this, just a reminder. If they get too many knocks against them, then we reserve the right to kick them out of the city. We don't want to go there, but you have to have some sort of credible threat, right? They have, if we report that their users are putting them in the wrong place, then it's on them to go move the scooters to the right place.
They have 4 hours to respond.
Right. So, and we don't have, you know, the resources to, you know, be out there constantly policing it, but there's, you know, we're sending them emails. We have, we set up an email address called dockless@slcgov.com so that people can send us emails if they see scooters behaving badly, and we can let people know. We also have a survey that is live. We'll keep it live until we have an ordinance drafted. So it's been live for almost a week now, and it's been kind of fun to look at some of the initial feedback we've gotten from that. It's the initial feedback is that most people really like them. Some people really don't. There's really no middle ground with these things. And those who, I mean, regardless if people like or don't like, we did ask, you know, geographically, you know, we broke the city into something like 15 neighborhoods and asked where, you know, are there too many, not enough, or the right amount of scooters? And in downtown, it was pretty evenly split between not enough and just right. And then in every other neighborhood, the survey respondents so far have said, by like huge majority, that they want more scooters in the neighborhood. So I think I think we're going down the right path with trying to come up with zones and trying to push them out of downtown and into the rest of the city. So, you know, it's something we'll still keep exploring. You know, how do we keep doing that? And something that I'm really interested in is with some of the areas like Research Park or, you know, here, or kind of what I call, like, you know, the industrial west side of the city, where you have, I think it could be a nice first last mile partnership, where I would really like to see some of these companies, and Green Bike as well, actually do partnerships with Backcountry or L3 and get, you know, maybe a whole fleet of these to help get people to and from the transit stations. You know, as the 5600 West BRT comes online, that provides a really nice west side transit spine. And, you know, I think as we're learning about trying to coax people out of their cars, they need, you know, walking alone isn't enough, biking alone isn't enough. You need to provide a broad suite of options. And so that's why we've tried to be supportive of these companies. It's just one more option.
So two questions. One, does the license agreement, is it apply only to scooters, or could it apply also to dockless bike share? And Ben Bolte's not here, he'd have a heart attack if we were talking about this, but like,
he did have a heart attack.
Will's here.
Oh yeah, true, indeed. So Will, so is with this, are you also contemplating potentially dockless bike share companies? So that's question number one. And then yeah. Two, you're talking about your Salt Lake City and the
right.
Zones, but like, how far have these scooters
range? Like, are they showing up in Taylorsville?
You can spy on them if you download their apps. You can get a good feel.
Looking for at it right now.
Jory's doing that right now.
There's some out past 215 out by 2700 West, and then there's some down at I-80 and Sugar House, or South Salt Lake, 21st Street. So,
So Mayor Overson's going to ride one back.
I could, couldn't I?
You could.
We don't condone the use of something, you know, in other cities. But you know, if other cities want to adopt similar operating agreements, we're happy to share what we've done.
And the agreement includes defines shared mobility devices as dockless bikes, e-bikes, and e-scooters. So it's inclusive of all of those. Huh. And I think that, you know, there are some challenges, obviously, that are coming to light. You know, a lot of probably
sidewalk riding.
Yeah, the sidewalk riding is probably the biggest thing that we've heard about so far in terms of receiving negative feedback. And we think that that's an educational piece, both on our side and on the vendor side, to educate people about where it's appropriate to ride. But we also have some challenges on the regulatory side. We have some conflicts between Salt Lake City ordinance, existing ordinance, lack of ordinance, and what state says. So we need to kind of see how that plays out. We've been invited up to the Hill next week to chat at the interim committee about this particular issue. The vendors have already reached out to the legislators. They have lobbyists and
they're
already talking. So for example, one of the regulations at the state level says that it's illegal to operate a device that has been modified from the manufacturer. So each of these vendors have modified the scooters to reduce the speed. So technically they're all in violation of the state code because they've been modified from their original position from when they came from the manufacturer. So that's one of the issues that they'll be discussing with the state. There's also a regulation that says that they can't be ridden on streets with a posted speed limit above 25 miles an hour. And we looked at a map yesterday of the downtown Salt Lake City area, and there's a lot of different speeds on the street. There's even streets that have, you know, we looked at one block, I think it was around Pioneer Park. Each of the four sides has a different speed limit. And on one street, you can have a speed limit in a certain area and then it changes to another speed limit. So in terms of trying to figure out what's the right speed limit, what makes sense, we want to look at how the speed limits within the city might overlay with our existing and future bicycle infrastructure. So what we don't want to do is recommend that people can ride in places where we don't have good infrastructure in place. If we can avoid that. So there are a couple things that we're still trying to figure out. I think the good news is we have really made a strong effort to work in partnership with the vendors and build strong relationships. So we do have a lot of good communication back and forth. So far, we're able to communicate well with them, and they've been receptive to the things that we've brought forward, and we've tried to be receptive to their needs as well. It would be great if, you know, folks like WFRC or UDOT or Bike Utah would be willing to share the survey and even the email address. We want to get as much feedback as possible. Like John said, this is a living document. It could change in the next 2 weeks. It could change in the next 2 months. It might evolve over time, over the next several weeks or months, or the next year, while we're trying to craft an ordinance. And we do want to take our time with that, because if we're going to codify something, we want to make sure that we get it right, or we get as close to being right as possible. So the more feedback we can get about people's experience, both good and bad, the better job we'll be able to do of crafting that appropriately.
So I also think that some collaboration among municipal jurisdictions in the area would be good, because I think part of the challenge of this is going to be education, and if the rules are more uniform, it's going to be easier to educate. If they're different in different jurisdictions, then nobody's going to ever understand the rules.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I hope that, you know, we'll have a better understanding of the state perspective and the direction that they want to go. My gut feeling tells me they'll probably make some adjustments to
what they have that's existing right now. But we want to be able to be at the table and to talk to them about what we think makes sense, what we've seen in our own city, the feedback we're getting, what we've learned from other cities who have experienced this before us and are going through it right now. And then I think you're right, it would be great to also incorporate feedback from cities who are certainly going to be seeing these products show up in their jurisdictions as well. It would be better if we could be
uniform. For the user, the line between Salt Lake, Mill Creek, I don't even know.
People who live there don't even know. So
yeah. Well, that's one of the challenges with the speed limit issue as well. You know, you're riding a scooter and hopefully in a bike lane, not on the sidewalk. You're not paying attention to the posted speed limit sign for the cars. And so it's very easy to cross over into an area where you're not supposed to be and be in violation of the state code, or another one of their rules is that you can't be on a four-lane road. So technically, if you were to ride the scooter across 400 South, you would be in violation of the state code. So it will be good for us to be able to be at the table and talk to the state, but I think you're right, it would be nice for us to create a platform for discussion amongst the different jurisdictions. Be great to get feedback from other cities.
Jennifer?
And sorry, we're also recognizing that, you know, this has been a thing for not years but months, right? And so it could also disappear pretty quick. And we're sensitive to the fact that, you know, we've spent 8 years building up Green Bike as a thing and as a brand. And so we also, in all of this, want to make sure that they continue to grow and hopefully that this is something where the, you know, non-car mode is greatly expanded and not that it's something where, you know, they're pillaging, I guess, you know, cannibalizing.
So, Phil and then Jeff.
Oh, and I had sent Jen an email while she was on vacation. I had seen that Bird was looking at a fixed amount or a percentage of each trip going towards the development of bike infrastructure. And I mean, it seems like that's always the biggest challenge, is enough money to develop, and you know, how much are you going to generate from, you know, each trip necessarily. But if that's, I mean, I'd like to see something like that included in an ordinance, because if these companies are coming in and deriving some financial benefit, how are they giving back? Yes, they're providing a new mode, but how are they giving back to the community and creating the infrastructure that they should be using as opposed to?
And Bird does have that. That's part of their business model.
Is that something for all of the companies, though?
No, although I think Lime
does it as well.
They do it as well. I don't know how structured theirs is. Bird's is very specific. They will pay $1 per deployed device per day. So if they might have 500 in Salt Lake City, but at any given time there's 450 out on the street because 50 are being repaired. So 450 that day. And we're in the process of creating what we will be calling a donation agreement so that we can collect those funds. And they actually haven't specified what it needs to go to, although obviously bicycle infrastructure makes a lot of sense. But, you know, we also have to think about things like education and enforcement, and if there needs to be additional staff resources allocated to this. I mean, I know that before I went on vacation, I was spending easily 90% of every single day just on scooters. And I think the same was true for John, the same was true for Alexis. And we hope once it's up and running, we can pull back on that a little bit. But
we're looking at, and it's something we explored, is, you know, with our real estate folks, is, you know, can we charge, you know, because we're allowing them to leave these devices in a public way. And so that could be the nexus, is you know, we charge a certain amount for the real estate that they use, even though it's kind of a moving target. And, you know, so our lawyers told us, we don't really have any ground to stand on to do that yet, but if we can codify that into an ordinance, then we can start charging a per device fee for the for these companies.
We have to get it onto the consolidated fee schedule. There's a whole process that the city has to go through to be able to charge those fees. We can't just randomly be like, it's going to be $50 a scooter.
We should be. At
least. Yes, but we have to go through. But that's lawyers. part of our process. So that we'll be both collecting fees on the front end, and then also at least with these two vendors, creating agreements so that we can collect some of the revenue and then turn that around back in the city. Jeff, to be fair.
So the idea is that these scooters can be used in the bike lanes, and can they be used on any off-road paved trails, like the Jordan River Trail, the DNRG? Can they go on those? Are they allowed to go on those kind of facilities? Or has that not been decided?
I think they should be able to go anywhere a bike does. And I would like to see an ordinance that's kind of, you know, neutral to the device, and is, you know, anything that is like 20 miles an hour and under, you know, personal mobility devices should be able to go anywhere a bike goes.
How fast do they go?
These are governed to 15. But
they come from the manufacturer, they go up to 22, and they reduce the speed down to 15.
You're seeing a lot of people with their own personal e-scooters and one wheels and booster boards and whatever. The
e-bikes can go up to what, 28?
Depending on the
I think UDOTs go over 30, don't they?
I got ours up to 30.
Well, Park City adjusted theirs. They have a cap on the speed limit for theirs in Park City as well. The manufacturer has the ability to do that. But yeah, we don't know, because we don't have an existing ordinance that governs these devices. And while we did move really quickly to kind of put a pilot program in place, we want to really take our time creating the ordinance, because it's very nuanced. There are a lot of things to consider, and we want to make sure we get it right. Like I said, we want to make sure that we're in line with the state, so we're not contradicting with them. We can be more restrictive than they are, but we can't be less restrictive than them. We're learning from our sister cities across the country with what they're doing, and we also kind of want to see, like John said, is this a fly-by-night thing? Is it going to be gone in 6 months and maybe we don't even have to worry about it? Or is this something that's here to stay? We don't know. We're kind of feeling our way through it. But I think, you know, John made an excellent point that, you know, for us it's about providing choices for people, and the more transportation options we can make available to people, and the more we can influence how those devices are deployed in areas where equity is an issue, that's, we're doing a service to our community by doing that. But I think we also need to recognize that, you know, each of these devices has its place in the community. That, you know, just because we have, you know, a dockless bike share program or the dockless scooters, that doesn't diminish in any way the value of the existing green bike program that we have. I mean, if you're talking about changing travel behavior, having a docked system is absolutely critical for that. People need to know that when they get off the train at Salt Lake Central Station, that there's a bike waiting for them. And I would put Green Bike up against anybody in the country in terms of the way they balance their bikes and make sure that they're all in the right places at the right times, their safety record, their maintenance schedule, just the way that they run their organization. And people have changed their travel patterns based on the fact that they know they can rely on those bikes being in those locations for them, and they can use them to commute and give up their car trips in certain situations. And so, like John said, we hope that these are supplemental. Sort of the same way I think about when TNCs came into the market, and some transit agencies went, oh my God, what's gonna happen? It's gonna destroy transit. And some transit agencies, I think the wise ones, said, oh, this is great. How can we partner with them to make sure that we provide transit in the areas where transit makes great sense? And maybe, you know, let the TNCs take over in areas where it doesn't make sense. And I see a
TNCs
similar-
TNCs are Uber, Lyft,
sorry,
et cetera.
Uber and Lyft, yes. I apologize for using jargon.
This is a real interesting discussion, because I'm getting calls from people that are not necessarily complaining, but asking the questions that on the trails now, and these are paved trails, you're getting electric scooters, you're getting electric skateboards, you're getting roller balls, all kinds of electrical equipment, and even gas-powered scooters are sneaking onto the trails from time to time. This is just it's an interesting discussion about what the future is going to be and what we're going to allow and not allow. I'm just waiting for the time I just get my Harley Davidson right on the trail and go. So
I mean, if it goes under 15 miles an hour,
yeah.
I believe the Layton City Police Department was doing that for a while.
So I'd like to, we need to move on a little bit, but I actually think that this is something where we might want to consider forming like a task force or something like that to get some other jurisdictions talking to you about this. And because I think it is an issue that a lot of us are going to see. Even if somebody doesn't locate a bunch of bikes in Mill Creek, we're going to get bikes in Mill Creek from
they're
people
gonna
riding them
yep.
from Salt Lake City or whatever. So I think it makes sense to try to get ahead of this and from a just like I said, trying to coordinate the thing. So I'll be in touch with you about that.
Great.
And if other people have any interest in that, I think let me know or let these guys know.
Yeah, ATC seems like the right convener for this conversation on a regional level. So okay. Thank you.
And we'll send out as a follow-up to this meeting the ordinance, the map, and then John, if you could provide us the Dockless, is it just dockless@slc.com?
Dockless@slc.gov.com, but also the survey.
Yeah, and
like
the survey.
Be great.
If you can give us that,
survey.
We'll send that out and then everybody can look at it.
We created a web page for it. So if you go to slc.gov/transportation/shared mobility.
We'll send that out.
Yeah. Great, thank
you know when it's got its own web page, that's like a big deal.
Yeah, I just want to say that I totally did not page in. Compliments about Green Bike, but really appreciate it and share your view on adding these complementary modes to the multimodal network that we have could benefit, potentially benefit the bike, the existing bike share program that helps reduce automobile traffic.
Yeah, and I mean, I sincerely believe that as a transportation planner, all of us who are transportation planners know that there are certain components that are necessary for people to change their travel behavior, and not knowing if you're going to be able to grab a scooter and get from your transit stop to your office, you're not going to change your travel behavior for that. So all of these things are important, and I think they can all work together as a system, and the more we can work collaboratively together and figure out how that works and where it makes sense for certain mobility devices to be, I think the better off each individual vendor will be and the better off the community will be in terms of having reliable choices for transportation.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Strava, Heidi.
And Matt.
And Matt, yeah, okay.
So I'll just do a minor introduction on Strava. I'm Heidi Goodhart with UDOT Planning, and this is Matt DeLora with UDOT Planning as well. Anyways, this is a little bit of an update on where we're at with Strava and our active transportation counting initiatives. So as many of you know, UDOT and our partners, Wasatch Front, MAG, and UTA have financially kind of pooled our resources and purchased Strava data. So we have back to 2016, and just last month we renewed our contract for another 5 years with Strava. So we'll be getting data through 2022, which is awesome. So we'll be able to kind of, from a longitudinal perspective, see changes in behavior based off of facilities going into place, bike lanes being built, trails being built, infrastructure enhancements being built. And kind of year over year, Strava is gaining more popularity with their user base. So this is data that's kind of, people have to opt in to sharing their trips and their activities. So that data is aggregated, anonymized, and then tied to our roadway network and our trail network in the state. Do I point over there? No?
Okay. You should. Is it the forward arrow, the right arrow?
Let me turn it on and off again. There, okay. Power on, off, that works. anyway, so, you know, like I was mentioning, it's a GPS tracking device, and we kind of reap the benefits through their Strava Metro product. So Strava is kind of this outward-facing public company, and we buy their product data called Strava Metro. And Matt within UDOT Planning is kind of our point person that does all of the data analysis, reaches out with our partner agencies, and we can actually get data for anyone in the state who's affiliated with the state of Utah. So local jurisdictions, municipalities, consultants that are working on projects. We have a really liberal licensing agreement with Strava to share that data and to advance cycling and walking in the state of Utah. So I'll let Matt kind of get into the nitty-gritty details of how this data looks and functions.
So how many of you have actually used Strava Metro, the data? Raise your hand. All right. So then there's a lot of people who haven't. Okay, cool. How many people have at least heard of Strava Metro? Just about everybody. Okay, good. So I feel like I talk about it so much, people are probably like, man, get over Strava Metro. But it's a really good resource that we have, and we want to make sure that everybody and anybody who is interested in improving active transportation facilities and active transportation in the jurisdiction has access to it so they can use it as a resource. So it's primarily the product itself is used within a GIS environment, geographic information system, so you have to have a little bit of knowledge of GIS in order to work with it. But like Heidi said, if you don't have interest or knowledge of GIS, but you do want to have pull information from the data, I can be a resource to you, or we can figure out somebody who's a resource to you. But the primary three types of data that you get from this data set is in the form of, first, your streets, obviously. When you pull it into the GIS program, you have the full network across Utah, and with each small line segment, there's information on the amount of trips that have gone through that line, the directionality of those trips, the different windows of time, peak commute hour times, the number of trips that have gone through those time frames, commute, speed, all sorts of information. We also have origin destination information. So when you pull this into the program, there are these large 350 meter polygons, hexagons to be more specific, overlaying the entire state. So with each of these 350 meter polygons, it has information on origin and destination. How many trips have originated in that place and how many trips have ended in that place. And there's also, with our 2016-2017 data set, information on the intersected polygon. So essentially we can derive the pathway of each individual trip from one polygon to the next. And then we can begin to ask questions about what facilities we can assume that they used. Among other information. And then intersections, and then you can imagine in the GIS environment, these are points on a map. So with each opportunity that a bicyclist or a pedestrian has to turn on and off a facility, there's a dot there that gives you information on the number of trips that went through it, as well as the average amount of time that they wait at an intersection. So that can be very useful as well. So, yeah, that's what we have available. Let's see, there we go. We also have, Strava has provided a really cool data visualization service, a web map essentially. We have 2016 and 2017, and then forthcoming 2018, obviously in the next 5 years, where it's a very easy to use, user-friendly web map where you can go to these places and get the annual counts on different facilities. You can look at a heat map. You can pull up the origin destination information and everything else that I just went over right there in an easy to use format. So if you're ever in a meeting talking to engineers, or if you're ever, you're having a conversation, you can pull this up as a resource and begin to center your conversation around what the data shows on these facilities. Ooh. There you go. So as you can imagine, there's a lot of benefits to this. We can first and foremost understand the behavior across our entire network. We can apply it to certain projects that are forthcoming or that are currently occurring. For example, right now, 2300 East just got some fresh green paint, some nice bike lanes between, I think, 18th South to 39th South, something like that. And on Strava, you can see before it was a pretty well-used facility, but post construction and post-project, it blew up. So with Strava, we can begin to understand the impact that these different facilities and these different design standards, such as green paint, might have on users. It kind of is based off this idea that you build it, they will come. We've also, there's a project being done, or currently being done, on US 89 between Willard and Perry. And one of the engineers reached out and was wondering which parts of this facility should we prioritize for construction and the bike lanes. And we looked at the Strava data, we were able to see that 80% of all the users on the corridor were actually going northbound, and so they were able to say, okay, yeah, we're gonna start emphasizing the right side northbound construction component. And so we can bring context to these projects pre and post during using Strava data, as well as fill with, what was it, the junction, at Lakai and Little Cottonwood Canyon. You know, we can bring that into the conversation on design when the people are actually using these facilities. So there's a lot you can do with it. There's a lot of benefits to it. It's just a matter of us bringing the context to it for it to better inform our decisions. Like I was saying, we can prioritize active transportation maintenance demands, snow plowing, shoulder sweeping, things of that nature. We can get an understanding of age cohorts and gender. We can overlay it with our safety data, among many other things, dependent upon what we want to look at. Obviously, there's some limitations involved. And in speaking with those who have received the data, trying to get feedback on what their experience has been, what are some of the issues they might have with it, I think unanimously across the board, a lot of people say, well, we're a little hesitant using it because we don't know what percentage of actual users or Strava users, and so we don't really know whether a heavily utilized facility is actually heavily utilized in the grand scheme of things compared to everybody. And that's a very valid issue, but here I'll speak a little bit to something that we're doing in order to enhance the Strava data set and the information that we have for active transportation. And it does cater to athletic user base. People who are using Strava oftentimes opt into the social media platform of Strava, which people can begin to be a little competitive on certain facilities and try to beat records of times that people have performed on those facilities. So there is that component to it as well. And it does bring to light the fact that we do need further data collection, and which has led us to pursue a really cool project. WFRC with TAP funds is in October, I believe, purchasing active transportation point counters that will be deployed mainly within Salt Lake County.
But at Salt Lake, Davis, and Weber. So Davis and Weber also applied for them.
Yeah.
So we're coordinating through, I think, Jeff and the Davis Active Transportation Committee, and then Charlie Ewart with the Weber Active Transportation Committee. And I'm not sure who in Salt Lake is it. Bruce? Helen.
Helen. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Yeah, Wasatch Front, generally, yeah. And with the TAP funds, it's kind of brought to our attention the need for a rationale for placing point counters so that we can begin to create extrapolation factors and adjustment factors for our Strava data set to begin to understand what percentage of our Strava users represent our actual users. And being able to pull in information from these counters in an informed way will allow us to begin to understand theoretically what user behavior is across our entire network in terms of actual users. So we'll be able to create metrics that can go into our models, which will begin to allow us to actually bring active transportation as a primary component for planning, similar to our vehicles. Because for so long, so much of active transportation data was anecdote, people sitting on corners for 2 hours and counting bicyclists and pedestrians walking by, and if cities had resources, maybe a counter here and there, and that was about it. Meanwhile, vehicles have this insane system of data collection that is just light years ahead of active transportation. So this gets us so much further ahead of the game to become close to being able to produce the same metrics and data that we do for vehicles. So with the help of a group, RSG, that we've contracted to pursue this project, we're actually producing a statewide active transportation data management plan, where we're creating the rationale for where counters should go, both permanent counters and short duration counters, so we can begin to get ahead of the curve when it comes to active transportation data management. And we at UDOT, we want to be a resource for everybody to be able to go to a web service that has the location of all these counters, which ones are permanent, which ones are temporary, and pull that raw data out for planning purposes, and then begin to also have information about what the theoretical actual user, actual counts are across the entire network. It's, these are some of the key outcomes that are included in this project. Like I said, adjustment factors. So dependent on weather, dependent on facility type, time of day, other variables such as land use, we can apply adjustment factors to our Strava data to come up with what the actual count would be. And being able to do that statewide across all of our facilities is an extremely valuable tool to have, an extremely important information to have. And if you look around at other DOTs and other MPOs, there really isn't any other program out there like that. So we can really be state of the art in this regards in the future. This is just a little bit of a kind of an example. DVRPC, which is an MPO, I think in Delaware Valley River. I think that's what it stands for. Delaware Valley River Planning Commission. Yeah, if you go to their website and you go to active transportation, they actually have a really robust counting program where they have an interactive map of the location of all their counts, all their counters. And you can download that information and specify exactly which time frames you want and how you want it and whatnot. So we want to be able to have a resource very similar to this. And this is just for Salt Lake County, but with RSG and the work that they've done, and based off of Strava and all the other information that we're able to provide, this is a map of the different locations of these counters here in Salt Lake County for both permanent and short duration counters, within phase one and phase two for the permanent counters, and then over a 3-year period for short duration counters. And the permanent counters, obviously being permanent, they'll get 24/7 coverage of trips all year round for these facilities. And then short duration counters will actually go on cycles. We can get 2 weeks to a month of counts and then move those counters to another location based off of whatever our priorities might be. And then with those short duration counters, we can begin to apply these adjustment factors to understand what that annual count would actually be in those places. So really cool stuff coming ahead. And if it wasn't for Strava, we wouldn't be able to do these sorts of projects. So. It's a really cool time for active transportation and data. So, yeah, I think that's all I got, though. Yeah, does anybody have any questions? Anybody have any concerns? This is my information. Yeah, go ahead, Phil.
Oh, I just have a quick comment. So I've worked with Matt on two projects and with Peter as well on the projects on Wasatch. And I can't speak highly enough about having that data in these projects we've worked on. The one at Wasatch by Lakai, the main issue was transportation in winter, primarily people coming out of the canyon northbound out of Little Cottonwood Canyon. Well, we went into the data and said, okay, well, how many bicycles are really going through the canyon, coming through that intersection at that time? Is it feasible to stop traffic for bicyclists that are coming from that Lakai roadway? Because the vast majority of people, there's not that huge peak in the spring, summer, and fall. So that data that Matt was able to pull from the Strava was kind of the thing that changed the perspective on that project and allowed us to include that stoplight on that. And then we had another project on Deer Valley Drive in Park City that nobody had any concept of how many people were actually riding on that road. And if you broke it down and said, hey, 50% of the Strava trips are, you know, Strava's accounting for 50%, it was still something like 500 bicyclists a day on that roadway, on a road that doesn't have a ton of traffic in the summer, even that much. So So I would encourage everybody, if you haven't been using the data, to tap into that. And I think it's only going to get better once we have those point counters, because it's going to be a better true count of what's happening out there.
So. I don't know, Matt, if this is for you or Heidi or Phil or Jory, but there was an analysis done by many of us several years ago, the latent demand analysis, right? And if I remember correctly, the basic purpose of that was to assess what demand existed but was not for active transportation use, where people weren't actually riding because the facilities weren't there, the safety wasn't there, whatever the case may be, right? So kind of to your point, if you build it, they will come. Well, there's pent up or latent demand that people aren't getting out riding because the facilities aren't there. And part of that got it, there was a data issue there, right? We didn't have good data. And how does this, I'm trying to formulate this question, but like how does the Strava data and then what you're moving towards with a statewide data system, how does that relate to the latent demand analysis?
Yeah.
And how?
I can maybe speak to that.
Yeah.
You on the spot about UCAT study, it was our Utah Collaborative Active Transportation Study that really examined latent demand, I think predominantly in Salt Lake County.
Okay.
I don't know.
We did it regionally, all the way even up the box over there.
Okay. And Jen might be able to maybe speak to that one more. But I think that was even back, is it 2014 or 15 now?
12.
Or no, 2012.
Yeah, it's probably 11. 5 or 6 years
right.
old.
Right, and so if you imagine the context of the amount of facility miles that we've put out since then, right, like that study almost needs to be redone, and redone with a different context that brings in our active transportation counters, brings in our Strava data, and just last week at UDOT we chipped in, and I think Wasatch Front, Chadwick, and you guys are involved as well with a MITSI data pool study, where we're going to look at factoring related to socio-demographic aspects. So how do you control for active transportation use in a low-income community or a community that has certain number of cars per household? So we'll be able to kind of add that layer of data analysis. That study is going to be, 18 months out. So that'll still be like about 2 years away before we can kind of roll that into our methodologies, but that's an additional thing that's on the radar. And that'll really help us in areas where we don't have counters, and especially in like areas of rural Utah or kind of areas outside of our MPOs where we just kind of lack some data.
And Andrew, one other point on that. The UCATS was also, it was looking at propensity to ride, like who would potentially ride based on, some right. factor. So it was a little different in looking at the existing facilities was taken into account, but it was also like socioeconomic data. Where are our economic hubs? Where are people living? Where are they and how would they travel there? So it wasn't necessarily just like here's where they are riding. It's like where could they or where would they be riding based on? So just
right. And that's the real value of it, right?
Exactly.
It's not assessing what is happening, but what could happen.
Basically.
And I just wonder,
that's a component in it, but it also takes land use into it, at least when if you were looking at it, it took land use into consideration as well.
Yeah, so like areas around, and we did look and reference when Alta Planning did our Redwood Road or West Side Bicycle Connectivity Study, we did examine UCATS and latent demand on the corridor. And so this is the type of thing we could ground truth to some extent,
sure.
UCATS, but recognizing that the context has changed
a lot. Yes.
Okay. Thanks,
man.
Sarah? Let's talk about safe rides to school.
I'm Sarah Hodson. I'm the executive director at Get Healthy Utah, and we're going to kind of tag team this presentation. So Travis is going to talk first from UDOT about their Safe Routes to School effort, and then I'll talk for a minute about the health impacts, and then Mark Watterson from the American Heart Association will address some community concerns that he's aware of. So Travis, do you want to?
All right, so I don't know a lot of you in the room quite yet. I'm Travis Evans. I'm the new Alternative Transportation Safety Program Manager. So I'm basically Heidi's new counterpart on the engineering side at UDOT. So she finally has a colleague, so we're excited to get back to UDOT. So
I'm excited to be there. UDOT. No, I'm multiple.
Right. So I'm excited to learn more about all of you and get to know you a little better. First we want to talk a little about the SNAP program. We currently got a new contract under Penn of Powers to kind of rebrand the program there. Because I think most people know that when you search SNAP, if you just research SNAP, the first thing that pulls up is a food stamp program. Nobody sees SNAP. I think it's like on the third page, I heard, when you look it up on Google. So it's not very effective as calling it as a student neighborhood access program. So with the new consultants, we're going to rebrand it. We're going to call it Safe Route Utah. And once it's rebranded and we get the new program established and everything like that, then we'll come back and we'll present on that. All right, so part of my role at UDOT, besides the engineering side, is that I manage the Safe Route to School grant funding program. And so currently we are going to be advertising in early 2019 for the fiscal year 2022. We do a 3-year rolling program for the grant, so we know what's coming up and what's going on. The grant will be about $1.36 million, and I was pretty excited about that until I heard WFRC is doing some, you know, $50 million or something like that, $5 million worth of ATP funding. I was like, wow, it's...
$50 million, is that
it? Or $5 million, is that it? I'm sorry, I'm still really new, so...
I mean, it's 50 for all of our programs.
All of your programs.
This is one... If you want to compare total numbers, UDOT's total numbers are a lot more money than...
But you guys have that good focus on ATP. Yeah. But I'm still excited about the $1.36 million. And it's actually a state reimbursement program. So I don't know if any of you have applied for Safe Routes funding in the past, but typically it's a federal program, and that has a lot of requirements attached to it, with a lot of plans and inspections and a lot of things that go with that. So in making it a state reimbursement program, it's basically treated like a local project, and once it's complete, we then reimburse the project. So this way the money goes a lot further. So we actually just completed the grant round for fiscal year 19, 20, and 21. We had 59 applications. We were able to fund 28 of those applications. The average funded amount was $124,614. We were able to serve 25 communities. So we were able to spread that money around throughout 25 communities, which just kind of shows that we're, you know, we're not just focused on one area. We like to spread the money around throughout the state. There is no match requirement for it, so cities that are a little smaller, you know, like cities like Marana and things like that don't make a lot of money, are still able to apply for these funds, so they're not, you know, eliminated from the competition for this money because they can't put up a lot of match money. So that's kind of what I have for this. I know a lot of people, when they think Safe Routes to School, they think sidewalk projects, but we actually do partially fund Bike Utah as well. So we do a lot of program work, so don't just think, oh, I don't have a sidewalk project, I can't apply for money. Anything that will help get students to school safer, please apply for that money. And you can see, you know, out of 59 applications, we were able to fund 28. So we do have a decent amount of applications that we are able to fund. So that's really all I have about Safe Routes to School. But yeah, I encourage everybody to just keep applying for that. We'll have the new round coming out in early 2019. So if you have any questions, let me know. Again, Travis Evans at UDOT.
Thanks, Travis.
And so I'm just going to spend a minute talking about some of the health impacts of Safe Routes to School in addition to the safety that Travis talked about. There's obviously a lot of connection between transportation and health, but I want to just talk a couple of specific things about physical activity. The rate of obesity in Utah has risen over the past few decades, and this is a projection from the Utah Department of Health that if we continue on the same path, which it seems like we are, that the rate of adult obesity in Utah will be around 46% by 2050. So that's a concern in terms of the productivity and the health impacts and the costs that would be to the state. And then of course we know that the adults in 2050 are currently children. So if we can impact the health and the behaviors of children, then hopefully we can see some adjustments to that trend line. So children are supposed to get 60 minutes of physical activity each day, and there's a variety of ways they can get this, and some of that's at home, obviously, and before and after school programs. We also hope that they get recess during the day, that there's PE. But getting to school by walking or biking is one component of adding physical activity to a child's day, and that's a really cost-effective way to help them meet that recommendation. It can be actually quite a big percentage of their physical activity for the day if they're walking and biking to school. And we also know that kids who are active are better learners. Their test scores go up. Their behavior is improved at school when they're physically active. And so kids who walk and bike to school have that brain activity. They're better able to learn, particularly in the morning. And a lot of schools incorporate that into their day by doing these activity breaks where they teach a hard concept after kids have been active. So that's one way, if we can get more kids walking and biking, then their class in the morning time will be more productive for them. But we also know that that benefits the whole community, not just the child walking to school, that if there are other people in the community who want to walk around the community, if there are better sidewalks, better crosswalks, that everybody benefits from that. So that's an additional benefit to having safe routes for students. We also see that parents drive less, so there's impact on the air quality, reducing congestion around the school. Sometimes the complaint of parents is they don't want kids walking because it's too congested around the school, so you have to reduce the traffic in order to reduce the congestion so kids feel safer walking and biking to school. We also know that improves the walkability overall. So it's a good way to improve not just the health benefits of students, the academic performance of students, but the health benefits for the whole community. Mark's going to talk a little bit about some concerns that they've seen and then some potential solutions related to safe routes to school.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. So what does this look like when we talk about safe routes to school? The past several years, we've actually worked with a group out of BYU, health promotion class, in which they, working with the PTA and the local school districts, you get a group of students that actually adopt a school, for lack of a better word. And working with school officials, local PTA, and parents, they actually do audits of the school area, trying to identify, okay, what are the problem areas that we have? Currently, state law requires that the bus transportation is not allowed for students who live within a mile and a half of an elementary school or 2 miles of middle school or high school. And so it leaves that bubble around these schools in which these students, either their parents take them to school, which adds to the congestion, which Sarah talked about, or they have to try and find some way to walk or bike to school. And so Safe Routes to School is really trying to identify what are the problem areas within that mile and a half or that 2 mile bubble, and what can we do to fix it so that students can actually travel to and from school safely. So these students that we worked with went around and they gathered stories and they took pictures. You can see here, this was just an issue of a trail that actually led to the school, but it led to a lock gate. And that lock gate actually made students have to find another route. It took about 15 minutes extra time just to try and get to school. You also have issues like simply trying to cross the street to get to the school. You have missing crosswalks or incomplete sidewalks and curbs. These are the kind of things that Safe Routes to School really gets to and addresses to try to fix. I'll be completely honest with you. When we took these to a city official in the engineering department, his response was, this just isn't a priority right now. It's going to have to take a kid getting hit and killed before the city's going to invest money in this. And for us, that's what we're hoping to avoid, obviously. The last thing that you want is a crosswalk named after some kid who unfortunately was hit and killed. Something that I think going up into Weber County, you actually had happen within the last year or two. So Safe Routes to School really gets at this issue of how do we try and create the better infrastructure within that mile and a half or 2 mile bubble around these schools. Sarah actually already touched on this slide. It really talks about, you know, the fewer injuries that occur when we actually invest in these infrastructure projects. The great thing that, that Travis had touched on, one of the issues that we've received feedback from cities is that, you know what, it's really costly to try and put in a sidewalk or paint a crosswalk or any of these other things. With the change in the funding that the City Process School program through the Department of Transportation does now, is that it doesn't require those matching funds anymore. The unfortunate part in that is that now cities are saying, hey, we don't have to invest this money, so I think you're actually going to see an uptick in your applications, which, as Travis pointed out, they were able to approve funding for 28 projects. That still means that there's more than half of those applicants where those safety concerns still reside, where we are needlessly putting children at risk. So I know that through Wasatch Front Regional and through other MPOs that there's also some funding that can come through. The last I saw, I believe it was a 75-25% match. But feedback that we've received is, you know, to the extent that's possible, knowing full well that there's different rules and regulations as far as the federal funding, there's got to be a way to try and diminish that match so that cities are able to try and afford these projects or to pay for these projects. Also, a need to prioritize high-needs communities. High-needs communities being those schools or areas where 50% or more of the students would qualify for free and reduced lunch. For those that are wondering, for a family of four, that means that they make less than $32,000 a year. So obviously in those areas, it's likely that the revenues are going to be a lot less in it for those cities in those areas. So there's really a need for, when the applications are coming in, to try and prioritize those areas so that we're building a health equity component into it. Lastly, one of the things that I'll touch on is coordination between cities and the LEAs, or the local education associations. My understanding from the few years I've been working on this is that for a school, when they want to, or a school district, when they want to put in a new school, there isn't really any coordination or planning that they have to do with the city or local municipality. Part of that was that they didn't want, you know, this development going in, and all of a sudden the developers are charging exorbitant amounts for property for these schools to have to try and put a school in. And I can understand that. The concern is that in talking with the Safe Routes to School program directors in the past, a lot of your applications that are coming in are from new schools, because these new schools come in and all of a sudden the cities are left with trying to build the infrastructure around these. So we recognize that there's a problem that exists. I know that Senator Maine is aware of this and has talked about maybe running some legislation to see if there is some coordination that can take place. To the extent that this group can help leverage their connections with Utah League of Cities and Towns and others, we would really support your getting behind an initiative that addresses the concerns of the LEAs and trying to find, you know, cheaper property to be able to put these schools in, but it's not leaving the cities trying to foot the bill of, okay, now we have to try and build infrastructure around it.
Hey, just quick to that point.
Yes.
This discussion about coordination between school siting and transportation and data provided and shared with municipalities, between the school districts and the municipalities, as you note, is something that has come up relatively recently in the current transportation and tax task force that's meeting between now and the beginning of the next legislative session. Mm-hmm. So that's a topic that's on the table. There's been some progress that's been made in that regard over the past few years, but more to be done. So I'm glad you brought it up here, and if folks want to
weigh in on that or get more info, that's something we can talk about later.
Absolutely, thank you.
So 2016 SB 86 actually makes it so that the schools actually have to have more coordination. So definitely look into that as well. We're trying to get that word out there that it was passed, but I don't think a lot of people know about it. So that's one of my tasks now, actually, is to get that word out about the SB 86, that coordination does need to be.
Yeah, and that's something that we've worked with Senator Okerlund on as well, who is one of the sponsors on that. When we try to get the language strengthened in there to try and actually put some teeth on that coordination part, we've got some pushback from the League of Cities and Towns, and the LEA. So I think there's definitely some more work that can be done in there, but you're right, there at least has been progress that's been made. The last one is something that we're seeing a trend nationwide, which is actually a codification of the Safe Routes to School program. Up in Idaho, for instance, they actually don't have a designated Safe Routes to School program. My understanding is that they've actually been taking those TAP funds and then just putting in their rainy day, rather than truly turning around and investing it in the program. So we would actually support putting it in state code that Safe Routes to School program exists, and then trying to see if there's some more funding that we can get so that we don't have more than half of the applications that are denied every year. But the last thing that we wanted from this group was, how can we help? We're seen as kind of the non-traditional partners in this. All of a sudden, the health groups are getting involved with transportation issues. But if there's things that we can do, in whether it's working with the cities or with working with the schools or whomever, please let us know how we can help you so that we're addressing these issues that exist.
Thank you. Okay. So are there any agency or county city program updates?
One quick thing, I wanted to follow the theme of data for today's meeting and go full nerd mode. We firmly believe that we can only obviously measure what we're interested in. We only are interested in what we're measuring. Back in 2011, the behavioral risk factor for surveillance system, BRFSS, is a phone-dialed survey system that we collect a lot of our behavioral data. So we asked in 2011, do you travel via walking from place to place at least once a week? And back in 2011, we were able to report that about 21% of people were doing that. We did not ask if it was a commute, because we were looking, again, age 18 and up. It could be a destination to a supermarket. It could be to wherever you're going. But the idea was a place to place, not necessarily for just physical activity or exercise. Last year, we just got some preliminary data back that said that those numbers have doubled. So we've gone up to almost 41%. So, yay. I'm going to put all the blame on you. Anybody else? I just wanted to share that with you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
We received some funding from the legislature this past session, and part of that was for our youth bicycle education and safety training program. And so I'm pretty pleased to announce we're going to be expanding to a second truck. So right now, I think as of this week, actually, for our program year, we've reached 3,000 kids with one truck. So the plan is to get to eventually scale that up so we can reach about 6,000 kids. And just to give you some perspective, at grade level, there's about 24,000 kids in the state of Utah. So we'll be able to reach about one in every four kids through that program. And we're going to need help from you folks. The toughest thing is recruiting schools, is finding who the right person is at each school to reach out to. Is it a teacher, a parent, an administrator, whomever? So please start thinking about that, and if you have any connections at the State Office of Education where that might be a good inroad for us so we can get them pushing it out. But it's no cost. We do everything. We bring all the bikes, we bring all the instructors, so we try to make it as seamless as possible.
So Phil, what kind of lead time do you need on that?
In terms of scheduling?
Yeah.
We usually like to be about a month in advance at least, just so our staff knows where they're going to be going for the next couple of months. But we're already a third of the way booked for one truck for next school year. So
do you want us to send information out to the communities, at least in the Wasatch Front area?
Yeah, absolutely.
Know that this
and I can get you that information. So
yeah, we can put a little piece in our
newsletter that goes out to all the municipalities in the region.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Cool.
Thanks.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I have a quick update. I was going to bring flyers today, and I didn't. Plus, we're also trying to go a little bit paperless at the Utah DOT. But on September 26th, we are hosting the Move Utah Summit, which will have a focus on active, healthy, and connected communities. So our partners include Utah Department of Health, WFRC, UTA, I think Salt Lake County. We have a lot of great sessions lined up to talk about how to get communities activated, how to ascend their active transportation planning, and then what are some kind of key peak level kind of improvements or initiatives they can have within their community to focus on active transportation. And it's in conjunction with the Women in Transportation Symposium regional event at the Little America the following day. So there'll be a WTS evening reception kind of after our summit. So we hope to see a lot of you there.
I know we've already sent information out about that to everybody on our newsletter, and we'll keep doing so.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Anybody else? How about a motion to adjourn? Almost on time.
I'll second that.
On favor?
Aye.
Aye. Adjourn. Thank you, everybody. Next meeting, October 10th.